a rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded? Here's Tom Hartman.
And greetings, friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. It's Flag Day. It's Flag Day. What can you say? It's Flag Day. It's the day to honor the symbol of the ideals of this nation. The ideals of this nation, like, for example, the ideal that somebody is innocent until proven guilty. The ideal that somebody has the right to a trial if they are arrested. You know, it's just the Sixth Amendment, right? A trial by jury, that they have the right to a speedy trial. It's just the Seventh Amendment. That they have a right to, you know, that they have the right to make bail. It's just the Eighth Amendment. But tell that to the folks in Guantanamo. Tell that to Jose Padilla, who yesterday the Supreme Court turned down. The day before yesterday, I guess it was. One more time. They said, sorry, Jose Padilla, I guess is how he wants his name pronounced. You have to go back to the lower courts, back to that Bush appointee who is going to stall it a little longer. I mean, is this amazing? An American citizen. I mean, it's pretty outrageous that non-American citizens are in jail for 2-3 years with no crimes, with no charges being filed against them. This is clearly not just unconstitutional. This is shredding and spitting on the flag. That is, in my opinion, that is what this administration is doing. That's what they're all about. Today, 700 days today, speaking of spitting on the flag, 700 days today. Since somebody in a senior administration official in the Bush White House outed a CIA operation, brought down an entire CIA operation just out of revenge because Joe Wilson had the temerity to write an op-ed piece for the Wall Street Journal, or excuse me, for the New York Times, pointing out that George Bush was lying to us. And so they brought down to get him. They got his wife, and by getting his wife, they brought down an entire CIA operation. Who committed that treason, and along with Bob Novak, who committed that treason?
And I don't know. We're going to find out. The senior administration official. Now, this is a large administration, and there's a lot of senior officials. I don't have any idea.
Now, in the meantime, of course, everybody is all hysterical about Howard Dean. I don't hear anybody talking about Bush saying that. I don't hear any, you know, it's 1,481 days since 9/11. And we still don't have our ports secure. We're only checking 3% of the cargo that's coming into the United States. Only about 8 or 9% of the cargo on commercial aircraft. We've got a great show for you if you're going to fly. We're going to make you, it's really going to look like we're doing something. But don't look in the belly of that airplane, please. 1,481 days since 9/11. And this administration has still failed to secure our borders. We still have, you know, 1 million, 2 million, 3 million people a year coming into this country illegally. 827 days since George Bush declared war on Iraq, in which he turned to the Iraqi people and said,
your fate will depend on your actions. Do not destroy oil wells.
Yeah, which certainly earned us a lot of friends in the Arab world. It's just, you know, how do you get it? I just don't get it. I just don't get it. And how many days has it been? Let's see here. 785 days since we heard George Bush.
My fellow Americans, major combat operations in Iraq have ended. In the Battle of Iraq, the United States and our allies have prevailed.
Oh, we've prevailed. Hoo-ha! We have prevailed. At that point,
The Battle of Iraq is one victory in a war on terror that began on September the 11th, 2001.
Oh, yeah, right. Let's make people think
still goes on.
That Saddam had something to do with 9/11. He didn't.
Terrible morning. 19 evil men.
15 of them from Saudi Arabia!
Ideology. gave America and the civilized world a glimpse of their ambitions. They imagined, in the words of one terrorist, that September the 11th would be the beginning of the end of America.
And George Bush has seen to it that there's some truth to that. Taking apart our civil liberties, building concentration camps offshore. Now the BBC reports 2 weeks ago that the Bush administration has drawn up plans to create a death camp in Guantanamo Bay for those detainees who ultimately are tried and convicted, so that we can put them to death as well. So we have five concentration camps down there. We're building a sixth one right now. And we're going to add a death camp. And the rest of the world is looking at us going, oh, that's what democracy is. And we're snatching people literally off the streets of our own nation and other countries, putting them on secret CIA airplanes, flying them off to countries where they will be tortured, where we know they will be tortured. Oh, that's what democracy looks like. It's a tragic day, this Flag Day, June 14th. A tragic day in America. And we need to stand up and speak out. I mean, it's just very simple. Andy Borowitz, the Borowitz Report, borowitzreport.com. Headline, this gets back to, this is really all tied together, what this gets back to. Mike Tyson replaces Dean as DNC chief is the headline. Promises to be a more moderate voice as the Democratic leader. Just days after losing to Kevin McBride on Saturday night and announcing his retirement from boxing, former heavyweight champion Mike Tyson made a stunning comeback today, replacing former Vermont Governor Howard Dean as chairman of the Democratic National Committee. In assuming the reins of the DNC, Mr. Tyson told reporters in Washington, I promise to offer the moderate voice that this party has been lacking under my predecessor. While the selection of Mr. Tyson raised eyebrows in Democratic Party circles, many called it a shrewd move, since the former heavyweight champ is expected to choose his words more carefully than the volatile Governor Dean. In his first press conference, Mr. Tyson told reporters he gave them a taste of the rhetoric that would characterize his tenure as DNC chair, telling them, quote, I want to make Dick Cheney my bitch, end quote. When Davis Logden, a reporter for the Toledo Blade, asked Mr. Tyson to clarify his comments about George Bush, the former heavyweight champ lunged at him and bit off his ear. Democratic insider Charlton Danziger gave Mr. Tyson a qualified thumbs up for his performance. He says biting off the ear wasn't that great, but he was still better than Dean. End quote. That's Andy Borowitz. It's tongue in cheek, and I got to say it bothers me. It bothers me. The whole characterization, this whole thing, what the media does is they create cartoon characters of people. And everybody has to fit into a nice little cartoon character. It's like the reality shows. You know, for example, the Trump show or the Survivor shows. They, in advance, they say, okay, we want one person who's going to be the bad girl. And we want one person who's going to be the nasty guy. And we want one person who's going to be the you come up with the categories, right? There's all these different the stereotypical categories. And then they go out and they find people to fulfill those stereotypes. And then they make sure that they behave in a way that fulfills the stereotypes. Why? Well, because it's commercial television, of course. But they're trying to do the same thing with our politicians. They're trying to, turn Howard Dean into a loose cannon. Come on, this guy's no loose cannon. Howard Dean was always a moderate Democrat. He was almost a moderate Republican when he was governor of Vermont. He was very middle of the road, and frankly, I think he still is. And, to his credit, frankly, it's middle of the road to me is different than it is to, Chris Matthews, who's, the closet conservative who voted for George W. Bush. But nonetheless, I just want to be on record as saying I support Howard Dean. And I think these characterizations and caricatures don't help American democracy, whether they're of him or anybody else, frankly, for that matter. I think that we should be a little more mature in the media. It's time for us to grow up. And in that context, the Chicago Tribune today, Dean sharply criticized the Republican Party, which has yet to support reauthorizing certain provisions of the Voting Rights Act that expire in 2007. Now, this is really interesting. You got Ken Mellman running around. Ken Mellman, the head of the RNC, the guy who was posting, boyfriend wanted ads on a gay message board a year ago. He's now the chairman of the RNC. And maybe he's the guy that Jeff Guckert was visiting all those times at the White House. But who knows? I don't want to speculate on that. But anyhow, he's here. Ken Mellman is running around to black churches. And what's not mentioned in the story is that last year, over $1 billion. Now, you talk about serious money in politics. $1 billion is serious money. Over $1 billion was passed out to churches under this faith-based initiative program, which was not passed into law by the legislature. It was created by administrative fiat. George Bush created this with a stroke of a pen. He's trying to get Congress to reauthorize it. But he can, you know, every year he can just create it for another budget year if he wants. But of that $1 billion, a good chunk of it went to black churches. And surprise, surprise, all of a sudden there's a small minority, but a visible one, of black ministers who are coming out and saying that African Americans should be voting for George W. Bush. And George Bush's poll numbers in those communities where African American churches received part of that $1 billion in faith-based initiatives doubled in 2004. See, this is the thing. James Madison, when he vetoed in 1812, when he vetoed the first piece of legislation ever that suggested that federal tax dollars should be given to churches to care for the poor, he vetoed it. Not because he didn't want the poor cared for. He felt that that was a function of government. And, in fact, they went on to then create poorhouses, places, housing for the poor, the first public housing, 1812. But he vetoed the law that said that the money should go through the church because he said that there should be a wall of separation between church and state. And it wasn't because he was afraid, as Jefferson had been, that the churches, and as Ben Franklin had been, that the churches would try and take over the government. I mean, Franklin had fled Boston when they were hanging witches when Ben Franklin was a kid in Boston Common. And he got out of there, you know, in the early 1600s. He said, enough of this, I'm out of here. Or the late 1600s, rather. Early 1700s. And Franklin and Jefferson were concerned about the influence of church on politics. James Madison was concerned that the churches would be corrupted by government. And guess what? Here it is. And Ken Mellman is engineering the party's most aggressive outreach to black voters, frequently speaking in churches and to community groups in an effort to improve the party's performance before the 2006 midterm elections and the 2008 presidential race. Howard Dean says Republicans should not pretend to be genuinely interested in courting African Americans until the party makes a clear statement on the Voting Rights Act, which they won't do because they want to continue to be able to disenfranchise blacks like Ken Blackwell did in Ohio and like Catherine Harris did in Florida. Howard Dean, the chairman of the Republican Party, as you know, has made a big deal about attracting African-American voters, and this is a litmus test. If you're not going to support the extension of the Voting Rights Act, I don't know that you have a right to go into a black church and show your face. Go get them, Howard. 20 minutes past the hour.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
What a friend we have in W. Upright, strong, and resolute.
Oh, he's so strong and resolute, yes.
God wished him to be our leader. The court could not but follow suit.
This is the official theme song they play at the Family Research Center's meetings.
Justice overflowing its rim. Life doth flourish in all its aspects when we're led by such as him.
Oh, my, oh, my. Welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you. Do we see it's Flag Day? It's Flag Day, and do we see a pattern here? Let's speak of patriotism. Dick Gephardt served in the Air National Guard from 1965 to 71. David Bonnier, Democrats, Staff Sergeant, U.S. Air Force, 68 to 72. Tom Daschle, First Lieutenant Air Force, SAC, Strategic Air Command, 69 to 72. Al Gore was sent to Vietnam, enlisted in 69, went to Vietnam in 71. And with the 20th Engineer Brigade, Bob Carey, Lieutenant J.G. Navy, 66 to 69, Medal of Honor, Vietnam. Daniel Inouye, these are all Democrats. Army, 43 to 47, Medal of Honor winner, World War II. Lieutenant John Carey, Navy, 1966, campaign ribbons. Leonard Boswell, Pete Peterson, Mike Thompson, Bill McBride, Gray Davis, Pete Stark, Chuck Robb, Howell Heflin, George McGovern, Silver Star, and DFC during World War II. Jimmy Carter, 7 years in the Navy. Walter Mondale, Army, 51 to 53. John Glenn, World War II in Korea. Tom Lanto served in Hungarian underground in World War II, saved by Raoul Wallenberg. Those are the Democrats. Now, Republicans. Dick Cheney did not serve. He had several deferments, the last by marriage. Denny Hastert did not serve. Tom DeLay, great patriot, did not serve. Roy Blunt did not serve. Senator Bill Frist. Did not serve. Mitch McConnell. Didn't serve. Rick Santorum. A good guy. Send those kids off to war. Rick Santorum. No, he didn't serve. Trent Lott, surely Trent Lott, he's a, you know, no, he did not serve. Well, John Ashcroft, no, he didn't serve. Well, there must have been yes, he had 7 deferments so he could teach business. Well, Jeb Bush, he's our guy. No, I'm sorry, he didn't serve. Well, Karl Rove, I mean, he engineered the whole war, right? No, Karl Rove did not serve. Saxby Chambliss, he's the guy in Georgia who beat Max Cleland, who lost 3 limbs in Vietnam. Saxby Chambliss, and he campaigned against Max Cleland, saying that Max Cleland wasn't sufficiently patriotic, that Saxby Chambliss was more patriotic. No, sorry, he didn't serve. Paul Wolfowitz, the engineer of the Iraq, the whole Iraq. No, I'm sorry, he didn't serve. Vin Weber, he was cooking the intelligence. No, he didn't serve. Richard Pearl, come on, Richard Pearl, surely. No, he didn't serve. Well, what about Douglas Feith, you know, the head intelligence guy for the whole Iraq? No, sorry, he didn't serve. Well, Elliot Abrams, come on, he's on all the talk shows talking about all these military things like he's... No, I'm sorry, he didn't serve. Well, Richard Shelby, I mean, House Armed Services Committee? No, he didn't serve. John Kyle? No, he didn't serve. Tim Hutchison, surely, you know, the senator or the congressman who's so upset about Bill Clinton. No, he didn't serve. Christopher Cox? No, he didn't serve. Well, Newt Gingrich, he wants to be president. He seems to know all about war and peace. He writes about it. No, he didn't serve. Sorry. Ronald Reagan? No, due to poor eyesight, he made movies. Phil Graham? No, he didn't serve. Dana Rohrabacher? Come on, Dana Rohrabacher. He's always on the talk shows talking about how patriotic the Republicans are. No, I'm sorry. He didn't serve. Rudy Giuliani? No, he didn't serve. George Pataki? No, he didn't serve. John Engler? No, sorry. He didn't serve. You got John McCain. I'll give you John McCain. How's that? 29 minutes past the hour.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Just take what you need. Don't empty out this book.
And welcome back, my friends. Moving toward a bright and sparkling future by returning democracy to the United States of America. I'm Tom Hartman with you. Senator Sensenbrenner. Mr. Hoyer, Mr. Berman, Mr. Sensenbrenner, Mr. Sabo, and Mr. Pallone, he introduced the following joint resolution. Now, this was back in February. Why are we just now hearing about this? I've had a couple of people mention this, and one of the folks in the chat room, put the link in here this morning, just a few minutes ago. But I also, it was in our stack yesterday of stuff that I never got to. And here, but it's in the House of Representatives. I call him a senator, Congressman Sensenbrenner. In any case, a proposal to amend the Constitution of the United States to repeal the 22nd Amendment to the Constitution, resolved by the Senate and the House of Representatives of the United States and Congress assembled, that the following article is proposed to the 22nd article of amendment of the Constitution of the United States is repealed. That's the amendment that says that nobody can run for president more than two terms. Now, why is Sensenbrenner doing this? Why is he pushing this? Why does he want to repeal the 22nd Amendment? Could it be so that, are these guys so deluded that they think that if George W. Bush Jr. ran for a third term in office, that he would get elected? I'm baffled. Or do they want Bill Clinton to run again? I don't know. If you want to drop into our chat room, by the way, I learn a lot in our chat room. Certainly you can, too. Just go to TomHartmann.com. However you spell it, it's actually T-H-O-M and Hartman with two N's, but however you spell it will get you there. We have all four misspellings as far as I can tell. Go to TomHartmann.com and click on live chat and or chat room, and it'll take you into our live chat room. And then hold on the control key and click register and just put just plug in a name and a password for yourself. And, we're not keeping any records on this stuff. And there's, it's not like one of those things where you've got to go through a whole song and dance and just, drop in, say hi. No big deal. Easily done. And if you'd like to call the program, our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Tony in Washington, D.C. on the line. Hey, Tony, what's up?
How you doing? And I'd like to wish you and all and your family a happy Father's Day.
Well, thank you. A little in advance, but and yeah. The same to you, Tony, and your family, and happy Flag Day.
Oh, yeah. Thank you so much. Forever She Shall Wave. Just talking 2008, you just preempted. Since there seems to be a distinct fervor out there for people, for us to pull out of this invasion, I think, hey, so many people call it a war. How can it be a war when we weren't attacking Congress, hadn't declared war, but that's another issue. But
yeah, I think we should call it an occupation, actually, rather than an invasion.
Absolutely. And also, do you think that a Democratic nominee, and it has to be distinct, I mean, really has to be, because we already said that, the flip-flopping and all that kind of issue, can somebody run and say, we will get them out, because so many people on both sides of the aisle are saying, we don't want our boys and girls, our young men and women, and our wives and husbands, et cetera, over there. I'm talking about that's the basic distinction they're going to define if McCain runs or Hagel runs. That distinction will be the galvanizing leverage that will get people to the polls, no matter if they have, those electronic machines going on,
yeah,
computers. I think that distinction got to be on the platform.
I agree with you, Tony, and it's all in how you do it. I mean, keep in mind that Nixon ran for re-election on a platform against the Vietnam War that he himself was prosecuting. So, he had a secret plan to end the war. And so Nixon ran against the war, but he ran against the war by saying that he had a secret plan to end the war. It's like no politician can survive. George McGovern certainly couldn't. Can survive by saying, basically, we should just, throw up our hands and walk away, or we should declare victory and leave, which ultimately is what Nixon and Ford did. I guess it was Jerry Ford who did it. It's just something that is very hard to say out loud politically. And particularly the memory of Vietnam is what is haunting the Democrats, the memory of George McGovern. They ran an anti-war candidate, and he went down in flames. And I think, frankly, that what the Democrats are not realizing is that, number one, it was part of it was that it was George McGovern. He was a soft-spoken guy. If it had been Ed Muskie, he would have beat Nixon with an anti-war platform, number one. So, and the Republicans saw to it that they took out Muskie in the Democratic primaries, just like they took out Dean in 2004 in the Iowa primaries. They spent $1 million in Iowa, Republicans, against Howard Dean. He was the only Democrat that they saw as enough of a threat to George W. Bush that they spent money to take him out. But the other thing is that the Democratic Party, and all the Democrats, they're afraid to be anti-war because they're afraid of being labeled as being wimps or wusses or pansies or what, you know, you pick your favorite adjective. And you know, they don't want to, you know, they're afraid of that. And I think that what they don't get is that Iraq is not Vietnam. That in Vietnam we had, there actually was this widespread belief among middle America that Russia was going to get us, that they wanted to get us, that communism represented a real threat, that there was this domino theory that if Vietnam fell, then Laos and Cambodia and Thailand and ultimately allies of ours like Thailand and Taiwan and maybe even Japan would all be endangered, and that we had to have this bulwark against communism. Now, it was a weak argument. It was a lousy argument. Most of us didn't, you know, most of us on the left didn't buy. I certainly didn't buy it, but it turned out to be wrong. But nonetheless, it was bought by a lot of people. I don't think that a lot of Americans today, and the polls increasingly are showing this, believe George Bush when he tries to conflate or tries to mix together Saddam Hussein in Iraq on the one hand and 9/11 and terrorism on the other hand. And increasingly Americans are realizing that what we're seeing in Iraq is not terrorism, and it's not like the terrorists have all gone there. We haven't arrested any foreign fighters yet. We've been there 2 years. If we had one Syrian that we could hold up in front of the world and say, look at this, a foreign fighter, we finally caught one. One Saudi, you know, it's like they're not there. What is happening is that the Iraqis, like all people who are occupied, don't like being occupied. And they're saying, you know, get out of our country. And the latest Pew poll was over 90% of Iraqis want America to leave right now. And so I think that if the Democrats can figure out a way to spin it as we need to leave so that Iraq can become its own independent nation, then they may be able to win on that. But if it's just, you know, let's get out, you know, because it's not worth it, you know, Bush made a horrible mistake, even though it's true. I think that the Democrats are probably correct in their political calculus that would not be a way to win elections.
But a congressman has already stated that they got to have a timetable. So if they want to go ahead and bend the spine, I don't know how much they can bend their spine, but and I'm a small D Democrat. But they can say, hey, look, so-and-so said that we got to have a timetable. Wouldn't it be, because, you know, Nader going to get up there and say, we need to get out. We need to get out, and people like him. But couldn't a Democrat, a moderate Democrat, get up there and say, hey, this is the time frame. By the time I am 4 years out, the last person will be coming home, too.
Yeah, I think they need to. And interestingly, it was Jones from North Carolina, I believe it was,
right,
who is a Republican, a conservative Republican, who has come out and said that we need to have this timetable to get out of there. And, you know, he's a man of integrity. He actually attended at least one funeral of somebody who died in Iraq, and something, you know, George Bush has yet to do, and that's when he got it. And he talks about that. At that funeral, he suddenly realized that there's real people involved in this thing, and there's a real cost, a real human cost to it. Tony, thanks for the call.
Thank you. You
make a good point. It's always wonderful to hear from you. I do appreciate it. 1-866-889-8894, telephone number. Bill in New York on the line. Hey, Bill, what's up?
How you doing, Tom? I wrote about something on my web a while ago when it came to the elections, that they were skewing the polls to back the electronic votes when that was going to come through to, you know, steal the election. My idea is let's kind of take a page out of Karl Rove's book. We already know that between 70 to 80% of the population favors medical marijuana. We also know that about 60% or more prefer stem cell research. So what we should be doing is any candidate who gets put up for an election vows that their first duty of action when they get put in office is going to put through bills that will pass medical marijuana as well as the stem cell research, and therefore the candidate, I'm losing my breath here.
It's okay.
The candidate becomes the referendum as well.
Right. Like the Republicans do with gay marriage.
Right, but instead of making it an issue where you can say, well, they went to the poll and voted for the referendum, but not the candidate, make the candidate the referendum.
Yeah. Well, the problem with that is that a candidate, and this is what the Republicans figured out, that a candidate, in many cases, you really don't want the candidate to be the focus of all the attention because, you know, some candidates have a few warts here and there or some inconsistencies or whatever. But if you have the referendum and you have the candidate who has a congruent position with the referendum will have coattails. It'll bring the candidate along. And that's why they were so successful in their strategy in either 11 or 12 states with these anti-gay marriage referendums, the Republicans. And I expect to see more of this. This is why Schwarzenegger right now is calling for a special election in November in California, you know, basically to bash the teachers union and try and grab more, you know, grab power away from the Democrats and hand it to the business interests in the state and disempower the unions. Because the referendum in his mind is where he's going to grab the power, and then he'll use that to put forward the candidates. So,
well, then if we use the referendum, that means then the candidates doing it that way, then the candidates then should also be in favor of saying this is what we support and we want this to go through. And then, and therefore, now when the election tries to get stolen again, maybe you'll have more people who finally realize and go, something's wrong with these machines, they've got to go.
Well, I think the solution to that, frankly, Bill, is that we need to have exit polls like we organized for the Ukraine and for Serbia and for Soviet Georgia and Belarus. I mean, we actually organized exit polls in those countries. And in three of those four countries, we flipped the elections based on the exit polls not agreeing with the polls. And as you correctly pointed out, I mean, I was doing election returns on WDEV, one of the affiliates of this show. It's a station in Vermont. And I was there at 11:30 on the evening of the election. And at 11:30, more or less, the Associated Press reported, the Eastern Time, the Associated Press reported that Karen Hughes had just sat George W. Bush down and told him that he had lost the election, that the exit polls were showing that Kerry had clearly won by about 3%. And the AP reporter said, and Bush didn't seem concerned. And then, you know, an hour later, they're calling the election for Bush. And all of a sudden, as you well know, CNN was even modifying their graphics. The exit polls were all recalibrated.
Well, even during the election, some of the polls were being skewed anyway, where they were taking larger samplings of Republicans. That's what I meant, where even prior to the election, they were already trying to skew polls to begin with.
Right, and that's why I think that we need to have an unbiased polling company get in there. I think, you know, John Zogby in his bunch. I think the Democratic Party is crazy for not investing a few million bucks right now in building a grassroots organization and bringing Zogby in and setting up national exit polls to go with the 2006 elections. I think that they're just crazy to not be doing this.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly. Yeah. It is something that's desperately needed, and even the Greens should also join together with the Democrats as well to be supporting it.
I agree. Bill, thanks a lot for the call. Good to hear from
you. You're welcome.
I appreciate it. Armin in Sarasota, Florida on the line. Hey, Armin, what's on your mind today?
I beg to differ with your opinion of something.
Okay.
I think that George Bush's blind trust would tell you that this isn't a bad thing in Iraq right now.
Okay, clarify.
What do you mean? His investments and his blind trust. I think he's war profiteering, if the truth was known.
Oh, well, of course. I mean, his father is the Carlyle Group is the largest investor in war manufacturing and war materials in the world. And Paul Bremer comes back from Iraq, and what he's put on the board of the Carlyle Group. I mean, yeah, of course.
And another thing too, in my study, in my opinion of history and almost all wars, because timing is of the utmost importance for the study of the history of the wars, the ones that I've analyzed, and I think that a lot of these wars, the establishment powers that be, when they're selling them as convictions and ideologies and improvement in opposition to those ideologies of those other political entities that we're fighting against. And then what I think usually happens, human nature takes over, and I think they become like Vietnam and a lot of wars, all of them in my opinion, ultimately, they become excess corporatism.
Yeah.
Because the rules fade away, the fair play fades away.
Well, and you know, Smedley Butler, back before World War II, when he wrote War is a Racket back in the 30s, General Smedley Butler, he was suggesting that, he was talking about the Spanish-American War and some of our other efforts, particularly in South America, you know, Guatemala, Nicaragua, and like that. He was saying that, you know, these are wars basically to protect our business interests. It's like Jackson Brown and his song Blood on the Wire, you know, So there is that element, but I frankly don't think that George Bush got us into this war in Iraq so that he could make money. I think that that's a side benefit. I'll keep saying this. I don't think that he got us into it for war. I think that for oil. That's a side benefit. I think he got into it for political power. And everything else flows out of political power. If you look at the timing, you know, July, August, September of 2002, just before the 2002 midterm elections, they rolled this thing out and they got the vote on the record and then they beat up the Democrats with it and so cowed them and they set up the 2004 election with this thing. And that's, in my opinion, that's why he did it. I think this was all Karl Rove.
I think it was a combination of three things. I think it was currency. I think it was his allegiance to the corporate people that put him in. And I think it was covering his own butt and staying in or getting put back in.
Yeah, well, I think you're probably right on all those points, Armin, but I think the decisive one was that it would allow the Republicans to get the Senate back in 2002 and keep power, in my opinion. 10 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
The fact is that they tell you lies for name, like oil becomes democracy. The fact is that they tell you lies that then get different names, like collateral damage.
And welcome back, my friends. 5 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you. 1-866-889-8894, our telephone number. And the place where smart people get their news, Xavier in Santa Cruz is on the line. Hey, Xavier, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom. You were talking just in the last segment about voting machines and things like that and taking, you know, exit polls. And one of the things that I'm concerned about is I voted for Nader the time before last, and I allowed myself to vote for Kerry the last time. And I'm concerned about the Democratic Party, not just the DLC, but the DNC.
Right.
It's like the Democratic Party seems to do so many things that I just wind up smacking my forehead, go, what the, you know? So what I'm concerned about is the possibility, you know, I waited the last time for the last election that I thought that they had all this stuff lined up, you know, exit polls and everything.
Mm-hmm.
And this may be sound like a conspiracy theory, but I honestly think that the Democratic Party, the people who are in power in the Democratic Party, are in line with, and it's beyond Democrat and Republican. It's like the Democrats come into power, build up the economy, and the Republicans come in and do their profit-taking.
Yeah, yeah, and if you look at the history of certainly the last 50, 60 years, you see that that's been the case. And, you know, that's the economic side of it. The thing with the exit polls and these, you know, riggable, hackable voting machines is the part that really concerns me in addition to that. And that's the part that I think is going to take citizen outrage. And frankly, I think the Democratic Party should be involved with it. The last time I talked to Howard Dean, I suggested this, and he's like, you know, well, you know, it's that's a – actually, he was noncommittal. But you do have – in fact, I'll play the clip in the third hour of the program here. I've got a clip of Howard Dean actually hacking a voting machine.
Yeah,
He knows the thing. You know, I mean, he knows the drill. He knows it can be done. He did it on live television on Topic A with Tina Brown on her TV show.
Well, but Dean is saying a lot of things that I like, but I'm just shell shocked from all the past times I got back on board with the Democrats, and I like your idea of, you know, getting involved in the Democratic Party and, like, the Green Party or something.
Yeah.
But I really think we got to look beyond this and really be suspect about the people who are in charge in the Democratic Party, because I think it's really deep.
I agree. And it's taken a lot of years to get that way, and it's going to take a lot of years to get it back. It took a lot of years for the extreme righties to take over the Republican Party. It's going to take a lot of years for the extreme lefties, people like us who believe in clean environments and full employment and fair taxes and good schools and good roads and infrastructure and reasonable energy policy. It's going to take a long time for us to take back entirely the Democratic Party, because you got the DLC, you got a bunch of corporatist Democrats in there, you know, along with the others. And it's going to be a battle, but it's a battle that if we don't engage, we've lost. So we've got to get in and participate. Xavier, thanks a lot for the call. I appreciate it. Good to hear from you. I'm Tom Hartman.
Listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.
Wow.
uncovers corporate lies, exposes political corruption, and has a clear vision of what America could become. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live on radio stations from coast to coast, on Sirius Satellite Radio, on streaming around the planet, on RadioPower.org, WhiteRoseSociety.org, Live365's American FM, and on TV systems, on cable systems in 29 states, on CRN Digital. Welcome back to our program. Very pleased to have you with us. The Bioneers program, we have, we've on a couple of occasions here, we have had Bioneers guests, folks. Actually, there it is, our Bioneers music, and talked about Bioneers, biological pioneers who are working with nature to heal nature and ourselves. They peer deep into the heart of living and living systems to devise strategies for restoration based on nature's own operating instructions. Bioneers are scientists and artists, gardeners and economists, activists and public servants, architects and ecologists, farmers and journalists, priests and shamans, policymakers and citizens. Everyday people, often committed to preserving and supporting the future of life on Earth. They herald a dawning age of restoration founded in natural principles of kinship, interdependence, cooperation, reciprocity, and community. And so today I wanted to get on the founder of the Bioneers, the head guy, I'm not sure you'd call yourself that, but Kenny Ossibel, the founder. He's the founder and co-executive director of Bioneers. He's an award-winning journalist, filmmaker, and social entrepreneur whose books include The Bioneers, A Declaration of Independence, and When Healing Becomes a Crime, The Amazing Story of the Hoxie Cancer Clinics, and The Return of Alternative Therapies. He co-founded Seeds of Change and founded Inner Tan Productions, a feature film development company. Hey, Kenny.
Hey, Tom. How are you today?
I am great, but I'll get better. So glad to have you here on the program. How did Bioneers start?
Well, it evolved out of two bodies of work that I had been doing in the 1980s. One was a film that I made called Hoxie, How Healing Becomes a Crime, that's all about medical politics and the suppression of promising alternative cancer therapies by organized medicine.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a long, interesting political story, but at the heart of it is the Hoxie treatment, which is an herbal formula for cancer that apparently has great value. And as I discovered beyond the politics, I got into the philosophy of medicine and learned that what Hoxie represented was essentially what we would today call the school of natural medicine. And what he was up against with the doctors is something called allopathic, or you know, what we call conventional medicine, but also originated from something called heroic medicine. And they're two very, very different belief systems. What the doctors said was that the body really had no ability to help itself, to cure itself, and that they had to intervene aggressively with very invasive and often dangerous treatments or very toxic, you know, remedies of various sorts. And what Hoxie and the whole empiric school, the natural medicine school, were saying was actually nature heals. All we want to do is stimulate the body to cure itself.
But aren't there times, Kenny, when there are things that, as a consequence of evolution or even human intervention, you have organisms that, you know, I mean, look at the Black Death. There are organisms that most people simply can't fight off.
Absolutely.
Leprosy. You know.
Absolutely. And there's a place for, I mean, I believe in what we would call an integrative medicine that uses the best of all worlds. Certainly there are viruses that respond to certain antibiotics and so forth, or pathogens. But in general, what the doctors were doing were using things like mercury to cure syphilis, for example.
Right.
Or in the case of cancer, the idea was that to kill the cancer in hoping that you didn't kill the patient first. And
they're still doing that, you know.
Oh, I'm highly aware of that. But what Hoxie was really saying was, you know, to help the body to cure itself, and today we call that the immune system, and that's really largely the future of medicine. And that became, although I didn't know it at the time, the underlying principle of Bioneers, which is what we call working with nature to heal nature. That nature has this extraordinary healing capacity far beyond our imagination, actually, as to what is possible. And I can tell you one story from the Bioneers network that is, I think, exemplifies that kind of process.
Please do.
Yeah, there's a guy in Washington State named Paul Stamets who's a mycologist. He studies mushrooms and fungi. And he was very aware of the many medicinal properties of mushrooms. They're very powerful medicines that we'll see more and more of in the years to come. But he asked himself the question, if these are such potent medicines in our bodies, what are they doing in the land? Could they also serve an ecological healing function?
Mm-hmm.
And he got a chance to test his hypothesis when there was a big spill of diesel fuel near his little farm. And he threw his hat in the ring with a bunch of other companies that do what's called bioremediation to try to treat these toxins and remove them from the environment. And so they brought these cells of dirt that were about 20 feet by 20 feet that was contaminated with diesel fuel and let everybody have at it. And Paul inoculated his little cell with the spore from oyster mushrooms. And so everybody covers these things up with a tarp, and they come back about a month later, and one by one they rip the tarps off, and it's the stench of hydrocarbons, just the stink of oil, one after another. So if they were working at all, it was not very effective. And then they get to Paul's little cell of contaminated dirt and rip the tarp off, and it was literally blanketed with oyster mushrooms, some a foot in diameter. And they went and they tested the soil, and then they tested the flesh of the mushrooms, and they found no toxic residue. So this is another basic pioneer principle. In nature, there is no waste. Everything is somebody's lunch of either food or energy. And the mushrooms treated the oil as food, and they literally transformed it. And that's when the real magic kicked in, as Paul tells the story, because the mushrooms started to decay, and, of course, insects came in, and worms and maggots. And then birds came in to eat the insects, and they brought seeds on their feathers. And within a matter of weeks, this formerly contaminated soil had turned into an oasis of fertility and restoration.
Why aren't we doing that in up in Alaska, where Joe Hazelwood left us all that, or Exxon Mobil, or Exxon, I guess it was just back then, left us all that oil?
Well, this is the kind of thing that the pioneers are working on and that Paul is working on. But interestingly, the story continues because he got a call from the Defense Department, no less, who gave him national security clearance because, forget Saddam Hussein, the U.S. government by far has the biggest stockpiles of chemical and biological weapons in the world, and many of these weapons are 20 and 30 years old, and they're degrading, and they have no good way to get rid of them. They've just started an incinerator in Anniston, Alabama, to burn it, but, of course, that's just going to disperse it into the air. So Paul did a classic blinded experiment. He sent them samples 1 through 28 of these different fungi that he's collected from the Pacific Northwest rainforests. And he got a call back about 8 months later, and this what they were testing it on was sarin BX nerve gas, which is one of the most deadly human-created substances on the planet, a very, very powerful neurotoxin.
This is the stuff that the Om Shinriko, the cult of death in Japan, that they let loose in the subway in Japan, just a little tiny bit of it, and it killed 20-some-odd people and that whole thing.
It's lethal, and they have no good way to get rid of it. Well, it turned out that two of his mushrooms completely digested and metabolized the sarin VX nerve gas with no toxic residue left.
Wow.
So, you know, the solutions residing in nature consistently surpass our conception of what's even possible. So there's great hope in what we like to call the true biotechnologies.
So this insight from making the movie about Hoxie, and Hoxie's formula, by the way, was heavy on iodine, wasn't it?
Potassium iodide, which, of course, as you probably know, is stocked around a lot of nuclear plants because it's a remedy that's used if you're exposed to radiation. It blocks the thyroid against ionizing radiation.
Right. It prevents. I thought it prevented the thyroid from absorbing radioactive iodine, which is one of the primary byproducts of nuclear fission.
That's correct.
Yeah. So instead of getting the radioactive iodine, your thyroid's so loaded with potassium iodide that it just says no thanks, don't need anymore. But is that something that is there a growing consensus that people, either to prevent cancer or to fight cancer, that they should be taking potassium iodide?
Well, no. It's a good thing to have in the cabinet in case there is some kind of a nuclear leak, you know, but you don't really want to take it on a regular basis otherwise.
Yeah.
But it's quite useful. But that's the base of the Hoxie herbs, and then there's 9 different herbs in it, all of which have since been validated as anti-cancer herbs.
Interesting. Interesting. So you made this movie about this, and you were kind of getting it. You were figuring out that there is this interdependence, this interrelation, all this stuff. And how did that then turn into Bioneers? Because you guys have this. You have a conference. You have a radio program. You're involved in the media. You're doing a lot of things out there, and you've got a lot of people. You know, I spoke at your conference last year, and I was just amazed. There was a couple thousand people there.
Yeah, there were about 3,400 people in California, and then last year we had 15 live simultaneous satellite conferences across North America, where people gather locally.
So how did that come out of, you know, Kenny Ossibel saying, hey, gee, the, you know, there's something here to this nature working together stuff?
Well, I got very interested in all this, and I started to poke around as both a journalist and a curious citizen, and found one after another of these people that I came to call bioneers, because they had looked for nature's operating instructions, the basic question being, how does nature do it? And that was the commonality. I started a company in 1989 called Seeds of Change that was really a biodiversity organic seed company to bring diversity back into our food web, which was another, you know, diversity is actually the fabric of life.
Right, and that company's still around, by the way. Are they?
Yeah, it was acquired by M&M Mars, actually.
Uh-huh.
Ultimately. Okay. I left before that happened. But in any case, I realized there were all these amazing people out there, and so I held this conference in 1990 in Santa Fe, where I live. And it was almost like being in a revival meeting. You know, there were so few of us in those days, and it was just so great to get connected and to see the brilliance of the work going on. And then it continued to grow over the years. We moved it out to California after 3 years in Santa Fe because we outgrew all the facilities, and it just continued over time to grow. And what we realized is two things. One is that the educational aspect of it is just incredibly important. Most people just don't know that there really are these kinds of solutions. And as soon as people understand the viability of all this stuff, it really leverages the pressure for change. The first question is, why aren't we doing this, obviously? And so that, you know, we've done a lot of education. But the other part was hiding in plain sight from the very first conference in 1990, which was, you know, the work of all these different people was so obviously connected, but they were not. Nobody knew each other. And we now have come to understand over time that just, you know, the biologists say the surest way to heal an ecosystem is to connect it to more of itself. And that's what's happening now, is we're getting very connected, all of us. And this is a movement that's much bigger than Bioneers, as you well know. And, in fact, Paul Hawken did a presentation at the Bioneers conference last year where he did a web mapping of this amorphous, nameless, formless global movement that we all sense we're part of, and came to the conclusion that it's the biggest movement in the history of the world.
Wow.
The real issue now is that we all have to get connected, because that's where the real power is, and start to circulate these solutions and our best practices and our models and organize ourselves. And so that's where this whole thing is heading.
Biggest in, as a, not just in numerically, but as a percentage?
Yeah, and it's global, and it's in every town, every community, every, you know, class, culture, race, you name it. There are loose, basic principles, like the kind of things I'm describing with Bioneers. And, of course, you know, half the world's people today live on $2 a day or less, and poverty is a major cause of environmental destruction. And so we're never going to heal the earth unless we can create social and economic justice.
Yeah, well said. We've been talking with Kenny Ossibel, the co-founder, or what's your official title here, Kenny?
I'm the founder and the co-executive director.
Founder and co-executive director of Bioneers, their website, bioneers.org. And you can check it out and find out more information there. Kenny, thanks so much for being with us today.
It's an honor, and we'll see you at the conference this year, Tom.
Yes, indeed. You sure will, and I look forward to it. Thanks a lot, Kenny. 20 minutes past the hour.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back, my friends. Helping you win the water cooler wars with uncommon sense from the radical middle. It's Tom Hartman here with you. And welcome back to our program. 24 and a half minutes past the hour. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service with us with our daily report from Washington, D.C. Hey, Ellen.
Well, how are you doing? It looks like yet another one got confirmed. And this is the Thomas Griffith appointment, 73-24 in the Senate vote today.
Thomas Griffith?
Yes.
Well, that one flew right by me.
Yeah, well, in fact, some of the folks in Washington are saying that, you know, they're not happy with his issues on discrimination, but also apparently he practiced law with a suspended license in the District of Columbia, which is here, of course, and practicing law in Utah without a Utah license.
Which court was he nominated to?
The one they're trying to pack to the gills.
The First Circuit?
District of Columbia.
Oh,
I'm
my
sorry,
goodness.
The, you know, the, whatever circus.
Yeah, that's the first circuit is,
yeah.
is Washington, D.C.
Yeah.
That's, yep. That is the launching pad for the Supreme Court. And it's also the one where anything that has to do with federal legislation is decided. So it's arguably the most powerful and influential court
of
in the United States.
That's right. And
everything separate from the Supreme Court.
It's interesting because my dear friend Webb Hubble said to me the other day that, you know, he's hearing that they are just trying to pack that court in any way they can so that they will have total control over all federal legislation.
Yeah, because then if somebody sues and says, hey, you're not doing the, you know, EPA the way the EPA was intended to go, it goes to the First Circuit in Washington, D.C., and they simply, you know, if they've packed the court, then they just say, EPA, we don't need no stinking EPA. And so this is two now on the First Circuit, just
right.
in the last
and
week.
People are saying it's going to take 100 years to undo what Bush has done in 8.
Yeah, and that's probably not an exaggeration.
At least 50, because these guys, you know, if they're 40-some years old, they could stay on until they're 90.
Well, and not only that, they're establishing precedents that will live on beyond them. I mean, you know, Roosevelt's been dead for 50 years, and we still have Social Security. We still have
right.
unemployment insurance. We still have minimum wage laws, and we still have unionization in the United States. So the conservatives are all wringing their hands, going, "Hey, it's taken us 60 years to even begin to do to take apart what Roosevelt put together." So you know, yeah, it makes sense. 100 years, sure.
Also, the Bush administration is really pushing hard on CAFTA, and they are trying to advertise in people's districts, and they are really going full force at it to try and make people vote for it, like it or not. And, of course, the sugar lobby is one of the ones that is the sticking point in this whole issue.
Right, but then on the other hand, there are huge corporate donors to the Republican Party who want CAFTA to go through because they would just love to have another, you know, 30, 40 million people who are willing to work for a buck an hour.
Exactly, and the problem is, of course, it doesn't protect workers at all. We
yeah,
know
well,
that.
But who, in that case, let me amend my comments. They would love to have another 30 or 40 million workers who are willing to work for 20 cents an hour.
Most likely. The other thing that's interesting, Tom, is that, of course, tonight is the big Republican fundraiser, $2,500 a plate.
This is the one that the woman who was the porn star is going to, right?
That's right. But it's also, they are really very much leaning very hard. Apparently, one of the members of Congress who was asked to raise a lot of money did so, but then sort of said, made it clear that he would arrange for these people to be on the White House congressional list to get into the White House tours. Well, that suddenly came into a fast stop when one of the local press decided that. So there's just an enormous pressure on these members of Congress to sell these $2,500 tickets.
Hmm. Do you mean the event is undersold at this point?
Well, they've sold it at this point. But what they did is, you understand, because you can't give huge amounts of soft money to the committees anymore,
right?
Hundreds of thousands of dollars, or to these dinners, there's a cap of hard money, which is $2,500.
Ah, so this is, let's get as many as we can in under the cap as quickly as we can.
Yeah,
interesting.
You got it.
Interesting. Ellen Ratner with the Talk Radio News Service, always enlightening. Thanks so much, Ellen.
Thank you.
I appreciate great hearing from you. It's the Tom Hartman radio program here. Viagra for your brain. 29 minutes past the hour.
This is the Democracy Zone with Tom Hartman.
There's something wrong with the world today. I don't know what it is. Something's wrong with our eyes.
Oh, I know what it is. It's called George W. Bush. It's called conservatives. It's called these loonies who are trying to take over this country and have taken over the control of the House, the Senate, the Supreme Court, and the White House. And the American people are starting to push back. The American people are starting to say, hey, wait a minute. You know, we're all in favor of free enterprise and capitalism, and we would like to know that there is some semblance of job security, that our corporations, that our companies, that our businesses that are operating in this country have a loyalty to the United States and its citizens as well as to profit. A radical new idea, right? It's a radical new old idea. Our citizens are starting to say, you know, you can call it Clear Skies Initiative all you want, George, but we know that what you're trying to do is put more mercury into the air, is trying to weaken the standards for this, and we don't think it's right. We're seeing an explosion of autism across the United States, and a lot of people think it's linked to mercury, again, because we're seeing an explosion of mercury. And then you get Bill Frist, you know, secretly putting into law, into an omnibus spending bill, a little piece of legislation, a couple of sentences there that says that if one of the big pharmaceutical companies that he's associated with decides to put mercury into their vaccines, they can't be held accountable by anybody for that. And the American people are starting to say, you know, enough. We really don't think our tax dollars should be going to supporting churches. We really don't think the churches should be supporting politics if they want to maintain their tax-exempt status. Now, everybody believes in free speech. I certainly believe in free speech. I'm totally in favor of people, you know, religious people of all stripes speaking their mind. But if they're using the facilities of an institution that I'm paying for with my tax dollars, because they're tax exempt, and so I'm having to pay for their fire department service and their police service and their water service and their septic service and the rights of way and the roads that get to them and the federal government, the things like our, you know, maintaining a money supply so the money can be given to them and the airwaves over which they broadcast and on and on and on that, you know, Pat Robertson used to become a billionaire with and Jerry Falwell used to become a multimillionaire. If I'm going to pay for those things because they're claiming tax exempt status because they're a church, then I don't want them messing in my government. I think that's a fair deal. And if they want to get political, declare themselves no longer tax exempt. They can still, you can be a church and not be tax exempt. And you can be as political as you want. Nobody can stop you. It's a free country. Well, there's a few things you might not be able to say in a line at the airport, but you get the point. But a lot of Americans now are starting to say, you know, enough. Enough. These guys have gone over the edge. They've just gone over the edge. We want our country back. We would really like our country back. Our telephone number, 1-866-889-8894. Hank in Michigan on the line. Hey, Hank, what's up?
Just listening to the guy talking about the Hoxie products and iodine or potassium iodide. But I read an article back in October of 2004 from a doctor out in California, MD, who's mostly naturopathic in his attempts to solve problems. And he's talking about what a deficiency we have in iodine.
Oh, yeah. Did you know the most widely prescribed pharmaceutical medication in the United States is Synthroid? Synthroid is the synthetic thyroid hormone.
Right.
We have an epidemic, an absolute explosion just in the last 40 years in the United States, principally among women and principally among women who are more than 30 years old. An explosion in hypothyroidism, that is the thyroid, you know, not functioning properly. And there are some people who are suggesting that it might have to do with all the radioactive iodine that was spilled across the United States in the 1950s with the above ground nuclear test, you know, testing programs that we had, not just here in the United States, but all around the world. Number one, and secondly, that this may have something to do with the fact that there's not that many people eating enough fish any longer, and or other seafoods, and so they're iodine deficient unless you live on the coasts. And you know, we had to put iodine in our salt to stop goiter back in the last, you know, the early part of the 20th century.
Yeah, and for that purpose, they set up 150 micrograms to prevent goiter.
Right.
And if you go to a doctor and have an analysis done, a mineral analysis, they said, wow, you're really high in iodine. And that, is that good or bad? Well, you know, it's way over the limit. What's the limit? Well, now I see the limit's 150 micrograms, and reading this doctor, if you don't mind the name, can I mention the guy's name?
Sure.
Robert J. Rowan, out in California. He runs a Second Opinion newsletter.
Oh, yeah.
And he mentions that if you don't have 100 to 400 times that, first you're not feeding it, your thyroid is going to rob it all. Mm-hmm. But in women, if you don't have enough of it to feed the breasts, you're going to have major estrogen and cancer problems.
Yeah, interesting.
And likewise for the guys, guess where it is?
Yeah.
your prostate.
Yeah, well, and zinc as well. It's fascinating, and I don't want to turn this into, you know, the Dr. Dean Adele show, but you know, salute him. But nonetheless, I had a teacher back when I was not a school teacher, but you know, somebody who was a mentor who suggested that every single morning that people should take a teaspoon of powdered dulse, which is a red seaweed, and stir it into a cup of coffee and drink that down. And that was his solution to, you know, 90% of the problems ills that people have. And I have been trying to find some dulse here recently.
Dulse capsules, tablets.
Yeah, dulse apparently has a more bioavailable form of iodine in it. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure exactly why, but the red seaweed. But in any case, yeah. Interesting. Hank, thanks for the call.
Yeah,
I appreciate it. Good. It's fascinating conversations. You never know where these things are going to go or come from. Brian in New Jersey on the line. Hey, Brian, welcome to the program.
Hey, Tom. Always awesome to talk to one of my few heroes. Maybe I'll actually get to meet you one day.
Well, thank you.
But I wanted to bring it back real quick to a comment that Armin had made about the Carlyle Group and to bring up a quote-unquote conspiracy theory. I think a big problem is that it's too big, it's too expansive for people to see. And I think that they can all come back to one simple fact. I don't know if you saw the PBS documentary America Rebuilds, but you see the leaseholder of the World Trade Center complex, Larry Silverstein, he actually says on this public document that World Trade Center number 7 was pulled, which is the term for, you know,
intentionally demolished, yeah.
Right, and it takes weeks or at least days in order to do this. And whenever I tell people this, at first they don't believe me. And then they see the documentary and they go, well, why? And why is because he got about $4.6 billion off of this attack. In insurance payments. And there's an incredible website. It's called MySpace.com. It's absolutely free. You can sign up and you basically network with people with the same interests as you. I've been documenting this in very small, bite-sized pieces because, again, it's such an expansive issue that it blows people away if you try and just feed it all to them at once. If anybody wants to read my blogs, they're awesome. My screen name is DiggityBiggity. It's Diggity Biggity, and it's myspace.com, and it's just very well laid out. It's all facts. They all come from CNN or PBS, and I recommend that anybody that has a question about whether or not 9/11 was, you know, let happen by the government or anything, I totally recommend the blogs.
Okay, so what's your, Brian, what's your theory about, you know, what the Bush administration involvement in 9/11?
Well, it's huge because of the Project for a New American Century. I mean,
you think this was the Pearl Harbor event that back in 98 they said that they needed?
Exactly, and they saw it coming, and so in order to, I guess,
so they didn't create
the process,
they just saw it coming.
I think they saw it coming, and so they got this guy, this, you know, 79-year-old Larry, who's, hey, you're going to get $4.6 billion. Would you sell your soul for that? And some people, obviously, you know, the seven deadly sins, greed is one of them. And so he said, sure, let's plant some explosives. There's plenty of evidence that two planes did not take those buildings down. So immediately you've...
But why, you know, let me just interrupt you, Brian. Why would the buildings have to come down for 9/11 to have the impact it had? I mean, if two planes...
That's a very good question.
I mean, the two planes seems to me like that would have been enough.
That's a very excellent question. The reason is that these buildings were plagued with asbestos problems, huge asbestos problems. Nobody wanted to rent these buildings. So Larry and his company leased them out for 99 years, but he knew that he couldn't demolish them because of the asbestos in the buildings. The New York Port Authority, who owns these buildings, they were in court proceedings to try and get their insurance to cover it. They threw it out of court. 6 weeks before 9/11 happened is when Larry bought these buildings. Now that they're rebuilding on the site, he immediately made $450 million profit immediately off of building number 7.
Yeah, but that could have just been, you know, he was in the right time at the right place. I mean, that sort of thing happens all the time.
Exactly,
look at Donald Trump's career, you know.
It's definitely a right thing at the right time, but again, in order to set up a controlled demolition, which he admitted to, it takes days. You can't just do it in the 7 hours.
Well, no, he's now backed off from that. I mean, he said that what he was saying was, you know, just a figure of speech. You know, the building came down. He's come out publicly and said there was no controlled demolition. We didn't take anything out. That little sound clip has been taken out of context, blah-de-blah-de-blah.
Hey, all I'm saying is watch the actual film clip. There's no way it was taken out of context. He said, I talked to the New York fire chief. I said there was such a loss of life today that we might as well just pull it, and then we watch the building fall. All the fire chiefs on 9/11 have gag orders on them right now. They cannot talk about it. There's too much video evidence out there to say that WTC-7 was not pulled. There's too much MIT engineers have gone over the fact that the pancaking of the two Trade Center towers, it's impossible for that jet fuel to do what it did. The towers fell in under 11 seconds. If you were to drop something off the top of the building, it would take about 9 to 10 seconds to drop, you know, with air resistance, because everything, no matter the weight, falls at the same rate. In order for the buildings to fall at the time that they did, it would need a complete free fall. But there were how many floors? 70 floors underneath of floor number 78 that were still intact. So it would take time for those to pancake and collapse. You'd be stopping the progression, then it would go again, and it would stop, and it would go. It would take way more than 11 seconds for those buildings to fall.
Well, I mean, maybe not. I mean, you and I have, I'm assuming that you've seen the same kind of footage that I have on TV, on History Channel kinds of things, where they show them blowing up buildings, and they seem to fall apart quite quickly.
Right, but that's when they're blowing them up. That's when there's controlled demolitions taking away the foundation. In this, you had a plane hit the top, you know, your 78th floor, and now all the floors underneath of it are still intact, because you have firemen going up these floors. Basically, they know that this building is not going to fall. No modern steel structure.
So let me just get this straight, Brian. You're suggesting that these guys, that somebody knew that Atta was going to, and his merry band were going to fly airplanes into the World Trade Center.
Absolutely.
And they said, how can we make some money on this?
Well, how can we make some money? How can we, you know, yeah, basically, how can we make some money?
You know, I get it that when Bush got the August 6th presidential daily briefing that said, you know, bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States, and we now know that that was one of over 50 daily briefings that he had gotten over the course of 6 months,
which, as well.
Right, which said, and in fact, when he had been over at the G8 meeting in I believe it was in Florence, in someplace in Italy or in Europe, they had actually had to move him out onto a aircraft carrier or something, because there had been a threat that Al Qaeda was going to hijack an airplane and fly it into the building that he was staying in. And so it's not like, you know, and then what, 6 months later, Condi Rice is saying, if we'd ever imagined that somebody would hijack an airplane, we would have, you know, yeah, come on, give me a break. You moved him because of a threat of a hijacked airplane. But in any case, he had received all of these warnings and you know, it's pretty clear to me that, you know, he then took the longest vacation in the history of the presidency, and that even then he was afraid to go back to Washington D.C. Went to Florida instead. Even after, you know, he was like waiting for it to happen. But I can easily get that, because the documentary record, just from the 9/11 Commission's official report, makes it quite clear that, you know, Bush and the higher ups. I mean, Richard Clark was saying, you know, they're all running around with their hair on fire. They knew something big was going to happen.
Exactly.
What I don't get is you know, the leap that I can't quite make is not just that they knew something big was going to happen, and that it was going to probably involve hijacked airplanes, and it was certainly going to involve New York City and Washington D.C. You know, all of that we know now. The presidential daily briefings, they were, you know, the intelligence summaries were telling him that, the Israelis were telling him that, the Russians were telling him that. He knew that. What I don't get is how that then translates into some guy in New York City deciding to make millions of bucks off the World Trade Center coming down.
Okay, if you read chapter number 5 of the FEMA report, which is the official government story, it talks about how, even in their own report, they don't understand why building number 7 came down. I personally, and I agree with you, I don't know exactly how Larry Silverstein and his company are connected with, you know, the higher-ups. Upon billions of dollars, you know, the Bilderberg Group or the Skull and Bones, and, yeah, that's when you get into conspiracy. I'm just trying to prove that there was a motive for Larry to blow these buildings up. Where they're connected, I haven't figured that out yet.
Yeah, but that's the problem. He would have had to have known in advance that those particular buildings were going to be hit on those particular days. And frankly, I don't think that the Bush administration knew exactly. You know, I think that they probably could have guessed that those buildings would have been high on the target list, But I don't think that they knew exactly what the targets were, and I don't think they knew the exact date. They just knew, you know, roughly sometime in the late summer, early fall, you know, sometime. I mean, George just kept prolonging his vacation and prolonging his vacation after he got all these warnings that Condi Rice talked, you know, finally revealed to the 9/11 Commission and to Congress that, you know, he knew something was going to happen and he was ready to exploit it politically as far as he could, and he wasn't going to do anything substantial to stop it. I mean, if they had simply ordered all the airlines to harden their cockpit doors as 27 years earlier Congress had recommended and the Republicans had fought back because the airlines didn't want to spend the money on it, the whole thing could have been prevented.
Right.
Yeah, but, you know, Bush didn't, you know, it was a golden opportunity for Bush. As he said, he hit the trifecta. And they've been playing that, you know, playing that out ever since. But that doesn't mean that they were behind it, and that doesn't mean that this businessman in New York had anything to do with it. That's just where, you know, and I've read, you know, the new Pearl Harbor, and I've seen the videos. Everybody, you know, in fact, I've probably got 15 copies of them because everybody wants me to see these things, and I watched them, and I still can't, you know, here's two and here's two, and it doesn't still, I can't see where the plus sign is that makes it four yet.
I understand.
Yeah, well,
I'll do my best to find that out and call you back. Don't worry.
If you do, Brian, I'd love to know.
Oh, I will.
Great to hear from you. Thanks a lot for the call, and keep up the good work.
Bye-bye.
Bye now. It's 10 minutes before the hour, the Tom Hartman radio program, the radio support group of, by, and for we the people of the United States of America.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to Truth in Broadcasting, the Tom Hartman radio program. That's me. Today is Flag Day. Franklin Roosevelt, in 1936, July 27th, as I recall, of 1936, talked about how the new economic aristocrats, those who were seeking to reach out and seize control of government itself using the power of concentrated capital, were seeking to wrap themselves in the flag in the Constitution. But, he pointed out, the flag in 1776, as in his time, stood against mob rule and rule by the overprivileged. A pretty radical idea. Can you imagine a politician today giving this speech?
In vain they seek to hide behind the flag and the Constitution.
Speaking of the Republicans here.
But in their blindness, they forget what the flag and the Constitution stand for. Now, as always, for over a century and a half, the flag, the Constitution, stand against a dictatorship by mob rule and the overprivileged alike. And the flag and the Constitution stand for democracy, not tyranny, for freedom, not subjection.
There you go, our Flag Day comments from Franklin Delano Roosevelt, June or July, I forget which, 27th, 1936. This was his acceptance speech. When he accepted his nomination to run again in 36 as the Democratic candidate for President of the United States. And boy, did he really, it was a great speech, and he really kicked him around the room a little bit, shall we say. Coming up in the next hour, Hillary and Deanland, a behind enemy lines alert. What are the cons up to? I'll give you the Republican talking points for the day, so you need not listen to right-wing shows after we get off the air, because you'll already know what they're going to be talking about. And under the radar, what's going on with Obama? And what's going on with the Supreme Court? Strange ruling out of the Supreme Court. We'll get to that as we move along. It's the Tom Hartman radio program, where our talking points, I'll be sharing with you the RNC ones, but our talking points come from Jefferson and Madison, not some right-wing think tank or the RNC.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information. Rapid and radical return to the old values that made America great, the values of democracy on which this country was founded. Here's Tom Hartman.
And welcome back to the third hour of our program, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, broadcasting live coast to coast and border to border. Welcome back to our program where we run right way. Here's a tongue twister for you. Where we run rings around the right wing every single day. Yes, indeed. Welcome back.
Behind enemy lines.
Yes. Behind enemy lines. The talking points from the Reich. This the official talking points from the GOP. That, you know, as a talk show host, I get the conservative talking points every day. So I can tell you what, by and large, they're going to be talking about on the right-wing talk shows over the next few hours or perhaps even the next few days. And it seems like most of it is focused on promulgating the word Deanism into the language, getting this thing out there, and conflating Howard Dean in a negative way with Hillary Clinton. This is just fascinating. A roll call's Morton Kondracki. Says that Hillary Clinton is off in Dean land. This is a quote in roll call. Senator Hillary Rodham Clinton lapsed back into Dean land last week in New York, charging, "There has never been an administration, I don't believe, in our history more intent upon consolidating and abusing power to further their own agenda." Speaking of the Bush administration, and of course, she's right. But according to Morton Kondracki, that means that she is in Dean land. He goes on to say, Deanism, the trademark behavior of the Democratic National Committee Chairman Howard Dean, is the tendency to attract publicity for name-calling attacks on Republicans while offering no positive alternatives for governing. This also from Morton Kondracki. You will hear about Time Magazine's Joe Klein saying about Hillary Clinton, this in all probability will be the basis of one of Rush Limbaugh's bloviations, that Hillary Clinton hasn't really gone to the middle. On the Chris Matthews show, he said, Time Magazine's Joe Klein says, she's still voting as a liberal. If she wanted to go to the middle, where was she on the deal on the filibusters and the judicial appointments? If she's a moderate, she'll be part of the Sanity Caucus. She hasn't been. All right. Give in to the conservatives. That makes you a moderate. Come on. Wall Street Journal's Peggy Noonan put Hillary Clinton's recent speech to New York fundraiser. I'm just sharing. This is straight from GOP.com. This is right. These are the Republican talking points I'm sharing with you here. Wall Street Journal's Peggy Noonan put Hillary Clinton's recent speech to New York fundraisers in the same category as recent Dean remarks. This is in the Wall Street Journal. Peggy Noonan writes, "The component of Hillary Clinton and Howard Dean is actually not worthy of America." Excuse me, the comportment of Hillary Clinton and Howard Dean is actually not worthy of America. Can you imagine anybody having the audacity to say that somebody is not worthy of America? I mean, you know, somebody, I suppose you could say that about Ted Bundy. She goes on to say, Peggy Noonan, she goes on to say, "Their statements suggest they are in no way equal to the country they seek to lead, and something tells me that sooner or later America is going to tell them, but in a generous, mature, and fair-minded way." Yeah, right, like Peggy Noonan just did. Andrea Mitchell, Alan Greenspan's wife, you know, one of the lead right-wingers out there in the media, Andrea Mitchell, on the Chris Matthews show, quote, "This is Hillary having it both ways. She's still giving the base what they want to hear," end quote. Now, these are the Republican talking points. This is the I'm See, I'm telling you, why are they going after Howard Dean and Hillary Clinton? I'll tell you, you could ask the question very simply. You know, why did they go after Bill Clinton so vigorously? Because he was an effective politician. So is Hillary Clinton. I'm saying that as an observation. I don't agree with all of her policies, but she's an effective politician, a very effective politician. And Howard Dean is a very effective politician. Why is it that in the Democratic primaries in 2004 in Iowa, the decisive primary, the one that was going to, in large part, probably more than any other, determine who was going to be the Democratic nominee? Why did the Republicans come in and spend $1 million in the state of Iowa running ads suggesting that Iowans, when they hold their caucuses, should send that latte-drinking, Volvo-driving Dean back to Vermont where he belongs? When, in fact, if you, having lived in Vermont for 10 years, I can tell you, there's not a lot of people in Vermont who drive Volvos or drink lattes. Most of them drive pickup trucks, and they drink coffee from the local gas station. I mean, that's the fact of the matter. It's a very rural state. But nonetheless, they spent $1 million to try and knock Dean out of that race because they knew that Howard Dean, in a fair fight, and they were not going to allow a fair fight, Howard Dean in a fair fight would have beat the pants off George W. Bush in a New York minute. I mean, just boom, bang. And so the Republicans came in. They did the same thing that back in 72 when Nixon had figured out that Ed Muskie could, you know, they had looked at the poll numbers and they figured out that Ed Muskie could easily beat Richard Nixon in the election. And so they took out Ed Muskie with dirty tricks. Well, they took out Howard Dean. So here what we see is a full court press. Hillary and Deanland is the headline. And it goes on and on. PBS's Gwen Ifill. This is she says, what you saw this week was the old vast right-wing conspiracy Hillary Clinton back. She said that on Meet the Press. Gwen Ifill trying very hard to be a good conservative. Or David Broder with the Washington Post, saying that Senator Clinton's attack on the press is short-sighted. On NBC's Meet the Press, the Daily News' Michael Goodwin says, and I quote, and keep in mind, this is the RNC sending these talking points out to all the right-wing talk show hosts this morning. And all of the TV shows, you can expect to hear some of these quoted on, you know, Chris Matthews' show today. Now that we know that he's a right-winger and he voted for George W. Bush. Daily News, Michael Goodwin. Howard Dean, of course, only admits his openly admits his far-left views. Clinton has gone out of her way to emphasize more centrist values, but an example of many other speeches to party faithful and a fundraising event show that Dean and Clinton often say very similar things. That Michael Goodwin in the Daily News. Yes, they say very similar things. They say we should make Social Security safe. They say we should have a reasonable minimum wage. They say that we should have unemployment insurance that you know, lasts long enough for people to get a job in a bad economy. They say that we should have an environment that's clean. They say that we should be protecting our parks and wildlife areas and our natural areas. They say that we should have a rational energy policy that doesn't pump more and more carbon dioxide into the air, that actually will give birth to new industries in providing alternative energy to the United States and citizens of the United States. Yes, they say those things. Yes, they say that we should protect the manufacturing base in America. Yes, they say that we should have reasonable and rational immigration policies. Oh, all of these things are not in the interests of multinational corporations that don't give a damn about the middle class in America. They would just as soon see the middle class dry up and blow away because those pesky middle class folks, they keep wanting to have reasonable pay. No, we got to get CAFTA in here really quick to bring another 30, 40 million people into the American workforce who are willing to work for $2 an hour. Anyhow, going back to the Republican talking points, Patrick D. Healey. In the New York Times, they're quoting the New York Times, quoting Senator Hillary Clinton. There has never been this is again the same quote from earlier. There has never been an administration, said Hillary Clinton, I don't believe in our history, more intent upon consolidating and abusing power to further their own agenda. I think it's amazing that the Republicans are quoting her saying that and sending it out as if it's an attack on her. because I believe that what she's saying is absolutely true. It's a statement of fact. Senator Hillary Clinton, she says, Republicans have never been acquainted with the truth. This, again, from a New York Times article. Clinton, quoting Clinton. I can tell you this, it's very hard to stop people who have no shame about what they're doing. It's very hard to tell people that they're making decisions that will undermine our checks and balances and constitutional system of government who don't care. It's very hard to stop people who've never been acquainted with the truth. End of quote. The Republicans are sending this out to talk show hosts. These quotes, I am guessing that a lot of the right-wing talk show hosts will not use that quote because she's nailing them. Here's Karen Matthews, the Associated Press, quoting Senator Hillary Clinton, quote, we are living in a time when the other side doesn't want us to see the facts. Facts are inconvenient. Facts are stubborn, persistent, and annoying if you believe that decisions should be made on ideology and partisan politics, end quote. That's Hillary Clinton. The Republicans sending this out as an attack of her. And finally, the final attack of Senator Hillary Clinton, sent out to all the right-wing talk show hosts today by the GOP. Senator Hillary Clinton, quote, whatever it is that we slowly but surely built up during the 20th century, this current administration and their allies in Congress want to turn the clock back on all of that, end quote. So, I got to say, hey, Republicans, thanks. I didn't know she was saying such good stuff. This is marvelous. You know, we need more of it. Well, we'll see how it goes. We'll see how it goes. What does centrist mean? I don't get it. You know, it's if you ask the American people, if you ask the people of the United States where they stand on positions, do you want to have single-payer health care in the United States? You know, where you're free to choose any doctor. You can have insurance if you want. You can do anything you want. And all of your health care expenses will be paid for if you choose, you know, if you simply submit the bill to the government, and it's going to be taken out of your taxes. Your taxes are going to go up, but everybody's going to have single-payer health care, which means that you're not going to have to be paying it at work, which means that your paycheck is going to go up, too. And once we get the health insurance companies out of the way, because they're skimming 25, 30% off the top on this thing, once we get the health insurance companies out of the way, it's going to cost us all less. We'll get a bigger, you know, yes, you'll pay a little more in taxes. You're going to get a much bigger paycheck. And our businesses, our corporations, will be much more able to compete in the world marketplace because there won't be $2,000 worth of health insurance in every car that General Motors builds. And you ask most Americans, is that something you're in favor of? Yes! Why does that define somebody as a leftist? Every industrialized nation in the world has some variation on that except the United States. Does that mean they're all leftists? Come on, give me a break. And you have these so-called mainstream media, this corporate media, saying, oh, these are left positions. Being opposed to mercury in the air is a left position? I'm sorry, I just don't know what planet, you know, when these guys got off the spaceship or what planet they came from. It totally baffles me. Speaking of totally baffled, Clarence Thomas. Clarence Thomas, what is this guy up to? He's doing a bad imitation of Trent Lott. I'll share that with you right after this. Stacking jury by race. Just fine with Clarence Thomas. Go figure. 20 minutes past the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Democracy to the United States of America. Here's Tom Hartman.
Indian workers with tech support skills work for cheap and speak English just fine.
Yes, they do.
It's a jobless recovery. Why pay a salary? We can outsource all the work that we need. It's a
And welcome back, my friends. Tom Hartman here with you, 25 minutes past the hour. We'll be in a few seconds anyway, about 10. Welcome back. The Supreme Court. This is the Associated Press article by Gina Holland. And, it starts out fairly normal. The Supreme Court, siding with black murder suspects in Texas and California who contend their juries had been unfairly stacked with whites, warned prosecutors on Monday to use care in striking minorities from juries. Stephen Bright, director of the Southern Center for Human Rights, says the court is sending a very strong message that racial discrimination in jury selection is not to be tolerated. And Justice Stephen Breyer suggested a radical change in the way juries are picked. He was actually quoting or echoing Thurgood Marshall back, a half a century ago, who suggested something very similar, said that the only way to get discrimination out of jury selection is to stop letting prosecutors and defense lawyers dismiss potential jurors without giving a reason. And right now, a defense lawyer or a prosecutor can just go up to a potential juror and say, you're dismissed, just based on how they look, including their race, and not have to give a reason. So Thurgood Marshall had suggested there should be a reason. Justice Breyer says maybe we should do the same thing. But the Supreme Court didn't go that far. That would have been a major, major change in how things are. They just didn't have a chance to do that. But instead, what they had, you had this case. It was a 6-3 decision. And in the Texas case, the court ordered a new trial for a death row inmate convicted of a 1985 murder, a black-on-white crime. And all the blacks had been kicked off the jury, right? And the same with a case in California. And Justice David H. Souter, writing the 6-3 decision, said there was strong evidence of prejudice during jury selection. He noted that African-American jurors were questioned more aggressively about the death penalty, and the prosecutors shuffled the pool at least twice, apparently to increase the chances that whites would be selected. In fact, here's what Justice Souter said. He said at least two of the jury shuffles. Keep in mind, Justice David Souter, appointed by, as I recall, George Bush Sr., he said, and I quote, at least two of the jury shuffles conducted by the state make no sense except as efforts to delay consideration of black jury panelists. He added, it blinks reality to deny jurors were struck because they were black. He was joined by John Paul Stevens, Sandra Day O'Connor, Anthony Kennedy, Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and Stephen Breyer. In fact, in Dallas County, prosecutors not only have a long history of kicking African Americans off jury pools, they actually published a book, a manual in the 1960s. It was in print for 20 years, advising prosecutors to remove blacks and Jews from death penalty cases on the theories that they'd be more sympathetic to criminal defendants. So that's the case. And then along comes Clarence Thomas, and he writes a 36-page dissent saying that it should be okay to kick somebody off a jury because of their race. you get Thomas, this is from the AP story, Thomas, one of the court's most conservative members, has opposed black defendants in the past and has voted against affirmative action. Now, I'm not saying because Thomas is black that he should, side with somebody who's black. I mean, that's a pretty myopic view of it. But I would think that he would have a little better understanding of what it's like to be African-American in the United States since he is one. And, and I'm not going to go on, one of those screeds like some folks do. He's married to a white woman, blah, blah. No, it's not. It's not about that. It's about his, and I'm not going to try and psychoanalyze the guy. I'm just boggled by this. The other one, there was an 8-1 decision. The California courts made it too hard for defendants to claim racial bias in jury selection. Who was the one? Clarence Thomas. And I'm baffled. I'm sorry, maybe somebody can enlighten me. 29 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Yes, welcome back, my friends. 27 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman program, where being progressive never felt so good, where progressives fiendishly plot for total world domination. Yeah, you know, someday somebody's going to take that seriously, and they're going to call the Homeland Security Department on me or something like that. Who knows? It's at least I'm not saying it in a line in an airport. How's that? CAFTA, Ellen Ratner. By the way, just to wrap up this thing with Justice Clarence Thomas, in his dissent, this in the 8-1 case, he ruled, this was the all-white jury convicted a black man, Sean Johnson. And the other eight members of the Supreme Court said that the California courts had made it too difficult for defendants to claim racial bias in jury selection. In other words, you know, this is something that is real, that is a problem, that does accrue to the benefit of prosecutors when they're prosecuting a black defendant. And that makes it more likely that a black defendant who may be innocent will be convicted. And that's not, you know, justice. It's not something that you want. Right? This has got nothing to do with black and white, ultimately. This has to do with all of us having, you know, justice. And, but Thomas apparently doesn't think the Civil War has happened. You'll recall, the Civil War was a turning point in federalism, in American federalism. Before the Civil War, prior to the end of the Civil War, states were strong and the federal government was weak. It's a very, very simple equation. In fact, states were issuing their own money. States had tremendous power. The states in the United States prior to the Civil War were almost run like small nations. And in some of them, slavery was legal. In others, it was illegal. In some of them, they issued their own currency. In others, they used the currency of other countries. States enacted trade agreements with other separate nations. States had tremendous power before the Civil War. And as, you know, as anybody who grew up in the South and went to school will tell you, the Civil War wasn't just about slavery. The Civil War was about the power of states, whether states would have the right to, for example, secede from the Union, whether they would have the right to enforce their own kind of trade deals. Certainly, slavery played a major role in the Civil War. But it also ultimately became, you know, and once it got going, full tilt boogie, it became about, you know, the agricultural South versus the industrial North. And it to some extent. So after the Civil War, we ended up weak states, strong federal government. You know, to the point that Bobby Kennedy was able to integrate schools, even though there's nothing about that in the Constitution. And it's been applauded by people in the United States. And there are still conservatives, and I'm talking about, you know, pre-Civil War mentality conservatives, the Edmund Burke conservatives, the John Adams conservatives, the Alexander Hamilton conservatives, who think that states should have power, more power than the federal government, that all decisions should be local. And there's a strong argument to be made, by the way, let me acknowledge, for local government having a lot of power and states having powers. But there's also a strong argument to be made for the potential for states to end up, you know, tyrannically exploiting that power. I mean, this is, again, what we fought the Civil War over. So you have a relatively small group in the United States. They tend to be mostly secessionists. And they refer to themselves as the states' writers, you know, who look at the 10th Amendment to the Constitution that says that any powers not claimed in the Constitution by the federal government go back to the states, which was true until the Civil War. And, you know, the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendments were added, and basically a lot of power got taken away from the states and given to the federal government, and has increased over time. And some of it, you know, I'll agree with the conservatives. Some of it, I think, has gone too far. You know, I agree, you know, with some of the conservatives who suggest that, for example, the Patriot Act has gone too far. You know, Ron Paul from Texas, about as conservative a member of the House of Representatives as there is, who wants to roll back the Patriot Act because it's too much power in the hands of the federal government. Now, I don't think that power should be with the states either, frankly. I think the Fourth Amendment is pretty solid. You know, that you, if police agencies want to kick in your door, or they want to snoop on you, the government wants to snoop on you, regardless of which branch of government it is, they have to go before a court. They have to go before an independent, you know, part of government and demonstrate that there is some probability, probable cause, that a crime has been committed. So in any case, here's Justice Thomas, Clarence Thomas. The reason why he voted against the other, you know, he was the only guy who voted to say basically, hey, it doesn't matter that these black people got screwed in by jury selection and shenanigans played by the prosecutors in setting up, making sure that they were setting up all white juries when black people were on trial for crimes that were alleged to have been committed against white people. The reason why Clarence Thomas took the position he did, apparently, is because he feels that this should be up to the states. And in fact, in a brief dissent, Thomas said, a state has broad discretion to craft its own rules of criminal procedure, end quote. So, you know, it's one of those things, you know, nothing is so simple that you can boil it down to a soundbite, you know, generally. And this isn't either. Because there is a strong case to be made for limiting the power of the federal government. And yet, at the same time, there's also a strong case to be made for nationwide saying that discrimination is wrong. And if that, you know, if stopping discrimination, and justice is right, and if stopping the processes that impede justice means that the federal government has to step on the toes of the state, of states, particularly states like Texas or California, where the prosecutors were actually issued manuals that said, if you have a black defendant and a white victim, you know, even if, I mean, this guy is innocent until proven guilty, right? The defendant. But if you have a black defendant and a white victim, then be sure that you don't have any black people on the, you know, any African Americans, none of them, on the jury. And if you have to reshuffle or recycle the jury pool over and over and over again to finally get, just keep doing it. And, you know, I think that we have to, as Americans, say that, yeah, that's wrong. But Clarence Thomas thinks that's just fine. If a state decides that that's the way that they want their criminal justice system to work, that's just fine. That's Clarence Thomas's position. It's up to the state. And this is an example of conservatives putting ideology above common sense. Putting ideology, and frankly, above Americanism. Above patriotism, above, you know, on Flag Day here, above love of country, in my opinion. I mean, this is where we wander into the twilight zone, as it were. Yes, Clarence Thomas, off in the twilight zone. So, speaking of the twilight zone, CAFTA. It looks like, you know, there's a good chance. Bush has been pushing this thing. He's been president for 4 years, more or less, pushing five now. And he's been pushing CAFTA for much of that time. And it hasn't come to it. They haven't brought it to a vote because they have not thought that they've had the votes. CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement. And the reason why, of course, is because NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement, which began, they started pushing this thing with Ronald Reagan. I mean, it all goes back to Reagan. Well, it really does. And there's an excellent timeline that I had forwarded to Louise to print out. I don't have it here. I'll have to get it to you tomorrow. I'll share this with you tomorrow. Excellent timeline on NAFTA and CAFTA, and you know where these trade agreements came from. And once again, it all started with the so-called Reagan Revolution, the beginning of rolling back the New Deal, the beginning of rolling back the idea that there should be a middle class in America, and instead saying that the purpose of America and the American economy is of, by, and for multinational corporations, not we the people. That was the Reagan agenda, and that's been the so-called conservative agenda ever since. And I say so-called because there's nothing conservative about it. It's corporatist. It's not conservative. But anyhow, the administration now, full court press. They're pulling out all the stops. They're doing everything they can. They're bringing in lobbyists. They're bringing in corporate executives. There's probably more private Learjets that have flown into Washington, D.C. in the last 48 hours than in the last 3 months combined. Because they've got all these high-powered folks, checkbooks in hand, knocking on the doors of senators and members of Congress to say, you gotta pass CAFTA. Now, why do they want to pass CAFTA? Well, here's their sales pitch. Their sales pitch is it's going to open a zone for 44 million new consumers for American-made products, and therefore American manufacturers are going to just do wonderfully. Now, that's what they're telling you. There's no doubt in my mind, frankly, that that's what, you know, you're going to hear tonight on CBS, NBC, ABC, CNN, CNBC, MSNBC, CNN, and Faux News, is that there's, you know, 44 million potential consumers down there in Central America, and boy, our companies in America sure do want to sell to them, and therefore our companies are descending on Washington in droves, and it's just that nasty sugar lobby that's holding them at bay. That's the story you're going to hear. But here's what's really going on. What's really going on is there are 44 million people in those countries. And those 44 million people represent a significant economic force. But it's not an economic force to buy American products. Because if you look at all the wealth that they have, all the disposable income they have, how much stuff they can buy, all 44 million of them together add up to the purchasing power of the city of New Haven, Connecticut. So why are these guys working so hard? Why are they spending tens of millions, perhaps hundreds of millions of dollars to open access to a market the size of the city of New Haven, Connecticut? Well, it's the other side of the equation that you're only probably going to hear about. You'll probably hear about it on Lou Dobbs will probably tell you about it, and Keith Olbermann might mention it, and that's about it. And here's the other side of the equation, and that is that it's 44 million people who can manufacture things for less than the American minimum wage. It's cheap labor. Now the American workforce, which is roughly somewhere between 100 and 110 million people, we are, by the way, 24,000 jobs short of where we were when George Bush first took office. He has yet, to this day, he has not yet created one net positive job. Not one. He's still 24,000 jobs short of where he was the day he took office. Welcome to trickle-down economics. Doesn't it work wonderful? Well, now they want to take the 100 or so million of us who are in the American workforce and bring another 44 million into that workforce, bang, just like that, to compete with us. Now, who's that going to benefit? You think it's going to benefit you or me? Well, they'll tell you. You'll be able to buy more cheap junk at Walmart. Well, you know, yeah, there's less shipping costs than shipping things from China, I suppose. And so the cost of Walmart stuff goes down 1 or 2%. Actually, the cost of Walmart stuff won't go down at all. What'll happen is the profit to the Walton family, the five heirs of Sam Walton, the billionaires, in aggregate the richest family in the world, in America, perhaps in the world, the ones who are giving millions and millions of dollars to Republicans right now to do away with the inheritance tax, the big time Republican donors in the Walton family, they'll make more profit. You know, last year they made $8 billion in profit. If they had only made $7 billion in profit, Walmart could have paid all of its employees a living wage and provided them with health insurance. If they'd only made $7 billion in profit instead of $8 billion in profit. You know, Walmart, you know, Walmart just loves it when people go, oh, Walmart, you know, they're screwing their employees to provide cheap prices to be... No, I'm sorry, they're screwing their employees to provide high profits to their stockholders, to the Walton family. That's the bottom line. It's very simple. So, 44 million consumers they're going to be pitching when really what it is it's 44 million new potential employees for new maquiladora-type factories to be built in Central America, in countries where they, you know, and then you're going to hear the limp-wristed Democrats. That's an anti-gay phrase, isn't it? I don't know how to describe these guys beyond that in a way that doesn't slam somebody. I've got to figure out a way to say it. Wusses or whatever. You're going to hear some Democrats go, well, if we just had protection for labor and for the environment. No, I'm sorry. Come on. What, you're gonna say, okay, we're gonna have a trade agreement, you know, with these countries in Central America, and they're gonna have to have labor unions, and they're gonna have to pay a living wage. Well, a living wage in Nicaragua might be $2 an hour instead of the 20 cents an hour that they're being paid right now. Now, you know, these are, I don't know what the real numbers are, but you get the point. All these folks who are saying, oh, no, the way to make these trade agreements work is to put in labor standards and environmental standards. Yeah, it'll make it a little more expensive for business to do business in those countries, which is why the Republicans and the corporatists are fighting it. But it's still going to wipe out the American middle class. We need to go back to tariffs. We need to go back to tariffs that protect domestic industries on an industry-by-industry, product-by-product basis and say, okay, what is it that we really want to make in the United States, and what is it that we're perfectly willing to buy from overseas and no longer manufacture in the United States? And then let's develop a trade policy based on that rather than simply on what's best for the Walton family. 10 minutes before the hour, I'm Tom Hartman.
Fearlessly exploring the truth of the day, here's Tom Hartman.
I want to live, I want to give. I've been a miner for a heart of gold.
And welcome back, my friends, to the True People's Radio, the Tom Hartman radio program. You would think, I think we all would think that a resolution in Congress speak, doesn't even have the force of law, right? That a resolution, in other words, just a declaration condemning lynching and apologizing for lynchings that have happened in the past would be something that everybody, at least in the United States Senate, would be in favor of. I mean, doesn't it just make sense? I mean, How could any senator stand up and say that they would not support a resolution? This is not a law. This is not going to make anybody do anything. It's not going to make anybody pay anything. It's not going to establish any kind of precedent. It's not going to be the beginning of a court case. It's not going to grant or take away rights. It's just a resolution. It's like when the president declares, like when a governor declares the monarch butterfly, the state butterfly, you know. It's a resolution. In fact, actually, declaring a state butterfly is more binding than a resolution. Could anything be less controversial than expressing regret for having rejected decades of pleas to make lynching a federal crime? Could anything be less controversial? Well, apparently something is, because here we have 6 Republican senators who refuse to vote for this thing. Refused to co-sponsor the resolution, excuse me. Senator Richard Shelby, Republican of Alabama. Senator Thad Cochran, Republican of Mississippi. Senator Trent Lott, Republican of Mississippi. So that's the entire Mississippi congressional or senatorial delegation. Senator Lamar Alexander, Republican of Tennessee. Senator John Cornyn, Republican of Texas. And Key Billy Hutchinson, Republican of Texas. So you got the entire Texas Senate delegation, 100% of the Texas senators, and 100% of the Mississippi senators. They don't want to have anything to do with it. They won't co-sponsor the resolution. Oh, my. Time to take America back, my friends. Time to get politically active. Time to get out there and participate. Thanks for being with us today. We'll see you tomorrow. Same time, same place. Enjoy your afternoon, evening, your day. Make it the best you can.
You've been listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Check our website at www.tomhartman.com for archives of this program and more information.